Bibles to 1 Samuel, the 28th chapter. 1 Samuel chapter 28, and as you're doing that, may I suggest once again that we are glad for the presence of everyone. I hope that what we have done together thus far in our worship to God has been both encouraging and uplifting to you, and it's been the means by which together we can give glory and honor to God. We show our respect for His will by our presence here and our focus upon those things that we do together in our worship and in our study. And so for a few moments this morning, let's contemplate a story that is told in 1 Samuel chapter 28. This chapter records a period very near the end of Saul's life. It has already been told to Saul that he will lose the kingdom. And in chapter 28 and verse 3 of 1 Samuel, we're told that Samuel had died. The Lord stopped talking to Saul. But Saul is facing the threat of the Philistines, enemy to the south and west. And he needs information. And so he does what was forbidden of the people by the law. He went and he consulted a spiritist, a woman who at least theoretically was going to consult the dead. And Saul disguises himself and requests that she bring up or consult with Samuel, that even in death the prophet Samuel might provide him with some information, some guidance from the Lord. But the message that Samuel gives to Saul is not at all comforting. In fact, if you'll begin reading with me, in verse 15, the text says, "Now Samuel said to Saul, 'Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?' And Saul answered, 'I am deeply distressed, for the Philistines make war against me, and God has departed from me and does not answer me anymore, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I have called you, that you may reveal to me what I should do.'" There's some irony here that Saul would think that Samuel would reveal what God was unwilling to reveal by either prophet or dream. But nevertheless, he makes the attempt, and Samuel responds in verse 16, "So why do you ask me, seeing the Lord has departed from you and has become your enemy? And the Lord has done for himself as he spoke by me. For the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David. Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord, nor execute his fierce wrath upon Amalek. Therefore the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with you into the hand of the Philistines. And tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. The Lord will also deliver the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines." Gruesome news. You're going to battle, but you're going to lose. Israel's going to be delivered into the hand of their enemy. And tomorrow, you and your sons, you'll be with me. 24 hours to live, give or take, a day. Saul was engaged at the very time that he's told this in a practice that was forbidden by God. And I'm not sure if that's part of the reason that in verse 20 we're told that immediately Saul fell full length on the ground and was dreadfully afraid because of the words of Samuel. No strength in him. 24 hours to live. A lot of people don't get that kind of warning. A lot of people don't have the privilege of knowing that their lives will end in 24 hours, that they have a single day left. Life has a way of ending suddenly sometimes, unexpectedly. Occasionally we're worn because of sickness or some other calamity. But so very often we just don't know. But Saul knew. He knew that he had another day, one day, in which to pursue whatever his heart desired to do with that little remaining time, whatever he thought was important. And this morning, for the purposes of our study. I want each of us to play the game that sometimes we play. We do that when Ed McMahon sends us that envelope that says, you may have already won $5 million. Of course, you know that Ed McMahon doesn't know the way to your house, never will come to your house. But we sometimes play that little game, don't we? Well, if I won the $5 million, what I would do is, and we begin to imagine how we would disperse that money, what we would do with it. And I think such games, while maybe a little childish, they also tend to help us in some ways sort out some priorities. What would you do if you had more opportunity? And there are some lessons to be learned there. Well, I want you to play a game with me this morning. I want you to imagine that you and I, just like Saul, have 24 hours left with which we may use our lives, live our lives. What would we do with our remaining hours? The prophet Hezekiah was told, the king Hezekiah was told by the prophet Isaiah that he was going to die. 2 Kings, the 20th chapter, the first couple of verses. The Lord eventually extended the life of Hezekiah by 15 years, but Hezekiah was told initially in verse 1 of 2 Kings 20 that what he needed to do was set his house in order, for you shall die and not live. He was sick. What would it take to set your house in order? If you knew that all that was left to you was 24 hours, if you got the same information that Saul was privileged to receive, you're going to die in the next day, what would it take for you to get ready? This morning I want to suggest to you some things that I would do with my final 24 hours. I suspect that some of these things are the same kinds of things that you would do. And may I suggest to you that there's no way in the world that I could take and in 24 hours I could undo all of the mistakes or undo the neglect that I may have spent a lifetime accumulating. But I will tell you that in the last 24 hours I would want to do those things that were the most important. And so I encourage you to think along with me along those lines about what's really important in your life, what you ought to be doing with your time today, as though perhaps it were the last day of our lives. I guess I would begin by expressing feelings to parents, siblings, friends, that for various reasons maybe I just haven't done. Children often are embarrassed, too embarrassed, or see it as a matter of weakness to say that they love their parents. That is, to tell their parents that. They might tell somebody else. But to say to your father, your mother, that's just not cool, particularly when you reach a certain age. And after all, they really know anyway, don't they? You really don't have to say it because they understand. It's implicitly understood, if not explicitly stated. But you know, if you only had one day left, wouldn't you want to make sure that it was understood what perhaps wasn't understood so clearly? I think I would make some phone calls. I would call some people that I know who over the years have in various ways been very good to me. People have helped me in a number of different ways, spiritually, physically, etc. I would want them to know in the last opportunity that I have just how much their assistance meant to me. How much their friendship was worth. I will tell you that on many occasions, I have determined to do that. Any of you write those end of the year Christmas letters where you kind of update all your friends on everything that's going on in your family, and you tell them about what's going on with your kids and how things are going on in your family, what's going on at work and where you went? You know, there's kind of a summary of the year. And the reason you do that is maybe you've got a lot of friends and it's just difficult for you to write personal letters to everybody, but these are people that you really want to know, you want to keep contact with. One of my friends wrote me this last year, email, nobody writes snail mail anymore, email, saying, well, listen, we'd like to hear, is there anybody in the Dvorak clan still alive? Meaning my particular chapter of that clan. And I wrote back and I said, yes, and I'll tell you later about all of it. Because I'm going to write one of those Christmas end of the year letters and I'm going to tell everybody about all the things that have been going on in our family. It's May. I haven't written it yet. Because there are just so many other things to do. And there'll be plenty of time to do that later. But not if you only have 24 hours. You would take the time, wouldn't you, then? You'd make that long distance phone call. You'd write that letter. You wouldn't be embarrassed to say the things that are close to your heart. Because time is fleeting. I would go a little bit further. And in addition to saying thanks to those who need to hear it, I would try to say I'm sorry also to those who need to hear it. Disagreements that really had seemed so important in the past, probably in the last 24 hours of your life, really wouldn't seem all that important anymore. In fact, it might be difficult in view of the short time left to even remember just what it was that the big difficulty was over. You know, in the last 24 hours, you could afford to be magnanimous. You don't have to be embarrassed in the future. There isn't any. I would try to forgive others who had sinned against me. For the very simple reason that that's absolutely necessary for me in turn to be forgiven by God Himself. Jesus made that point in the 6th chapter of Matthew in verse 15. That by being unwilling to forgive others, in essence, we cut off the very avenue of grace and mercy that we ourselves need. In Colossians, the 3rd chapter, Paul reminded us that we need to be bearing with one another, verse 13. And forgiving one another, if anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. You know how it is when we sin against one another, we have some sort of an argument or a fracas or something, whether it's with a brother in Christ or somebody else, and we just let it go and we let it fester. And it damages our relationship. And it may very well be that over time we intend to mend this, we intend to take care of that, we just don't get around to it because sometimes it's embarrassing to confront somebody with something they've done that's wrong. And it's certainly humbling to have to go to somebody else and say, I was wrong and I need your forgiveness. But you know, with only 24 hours left, I believe we'd need to take care of those things. Wouldn't have the luxury of waiting until some later date. I would do some other things that occasionally I have every good intention of doing and don't always get around to. In case you haven't gathered, this sermon probably is being preached to me more than anybody else. Hopefully you'll get some good out of it also. I guess I would try in my last 24 hours, I would try to express appreciation to brethren. I would try to encourage brethren as I had opportunity in those last hours. I would take a few minutes to do some of those things that seems like I was always intending to do and just never got around to doing. Anybody ever done that? You heard in services, so-and-so was sick. I need to call that person. So-and-so's at home. Need to send a card. I'll do that. Good intentions. And yet for some reason or another, maybe busyness of our lives or forgetfulness, whatever, we just don't get them done. Somebody did a good job in a talk or leading singing or some comment made in class that really helped you, wanted to say thank you, appreciated it, and yet just never got around to it. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul in verse 11 said, "Therefore comfort each other and edify one another, just as you also are doing." Edifying, the concept of building one another up. And then he continues in verses 12 and 13 to talk a little bit about our responsibility to elders. I'm not minimizing that, but I want to drop down to verse 14 and 15 when he says, "Now we exhort you, brethren," this is in a more general context, "warn those who are unruly, comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, be patient with all. See that no one renders evil for evil to anyone, but always pursue what is good both for yourselves and for all." Comfort the faint-hearted. Uphold the weak. But when will we do those things? Well, if I guess we had only 24 hours, we'd need to do it now. We'd need to do it quickly. It'd become a priority to us then. Whereas, because we assume we have so much time left, sometimes we put those things off. And the weak brother doesn't get the encouragement that he or she needs. There isn't the warning that in some cases is needed by the one who is unruly. The faint-hearted fails because there wasn't the comfort that was needed. But if we only had 24 hours, we would take the time, wouldn't we, to do the important things. I would turn my attention, I guess, to my family. We spoke a little bit earlier about the things that we would say perhaps to our parents as children. But then as parents, we would also probably want to take care of our responsibilities to our children. It might be that that would be the opportunity to tell our children just how much we love them. Now, of course, they understand that, or should. We've told them every time we beat them. "This is going to hurt me more than it hurts you. I'm only doing this because I love you." Whether they believed it or not may be another matter. But we may have tried over the course of our training of our children to impress them with the fact that we do love them, do care for them. The children need to hear that. Yesterday, I guess Friday actually, we left Wednesday, Debbie and I did, to go down and attend the graduation at Florida College. David was graduating. And so we went down there to watch him graduate. And it was kind of a tough time. It's the end of an era. Florida College and I will have a relationship for quite some time yet, but it'll be primarily financial without the presence of my sons. But nevertheless, it was kind of a sad closing of a period because both of them are now done at Florida College. Well, David's done. John's just not going back. He's going to another college. But even still worse was John came home for the summer, but David stayed. And most of you are aware that he's engaged to a young lady there in Temple Terrace. And for some strange reason, he chose to stay there as opposed to coming home and spending a wonderful summer with us at home. And so it was kind of tough to help him move from the dorm into another, the White Way house. That was an experience. And so I told the boys, I said, I want to talk to you before we leave. Good time to talk to particularly David, but also John, since the discussion had to do with things that concern both of them. And so we spent a few moments as it rained outside in the midst of this little itty bitty room that he will be dwelling in this summer, talking about the need to do right. If you just had 24 hours . What would be the most important thing that you could tell your children? That might be a tough decision. I guess it would vary from child to child. Different needs, different circumstances. But wouldn't you be impressed with the need? Wouldn't you be reminded of your responsibility as a parent to nurture and train in a spiritual sense? And so you would try to grab some sort of parental wisdom, some exhortation about remembering who they are, the commitments that they've made, if indeed they've already obeyed the gospel, become Christians. In the last hours of your life, would you fuss at them? Would you brush them off and say, well, I just don't have time right now? Because you really don't. You only have 24 hours. But wouldn't it be that that's so important that you would take time for that? And yet how many times as parents do we basically do that very thing? We just brush our children off. There are more important things. I'll confess I've done that a number of times. More than I care to count. In the last 24 hours, though, when time is fleeting, and I don't have a lot more opportunities to spend time with them or to talk to them, I would want to make sure that I took advantage of those opportunities while they existed. How about today? I'd want to tell my wife how I feel about her and also where the will is so that she doesn't miss that. As my spouse, she's committed her life to my care. And in fact, she cares for my life. We're one flesh. And yet it's so very easy as spouses to be careless at times with the feelings of those that we love the most, whether it's our children or those with whom we have joined ourselves in this one flesh relationship that we call marriage. I've said some pretty senseless and hurtful things over the course of our marriage. I would like to think that in the last 24 hours, I would at least have the presence of mind then to be careful about what I would say. We are married 24 years today. In a chapter, Paul told husbands that they have the responsibility to love their wives. It's interesting that in the context of this passage in which women are commanded to submit to their husbands, husbands are not commanded to lead their wives. That, of course, is an assumption that needs to be made in view of the command that's given to the women. But what husbands are told to do is to love their wives. And that probably says more about the type of leadership that a husband ought to exert than anything else that I could say. Husbands, love your wives, Paul says, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So, husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. And if you are one flesh, if you're that in that relationship where your relationship is so intimate that it can be described as one flesh, then the man who loves his wife does indeed love himself. You can't separate their lives to talk about loving one without loving the other. In the last 24 hours, I would be careful. I'd be careful not to say the wrong thing, not to say the hurtful thing, not to say the unkind or the careless thing. I'd make sure that she understood I loved her. And I'd try to do as much as I could to indicate in nonverbal ways that she's the object of my greatest love among my human relationships. I'll tell you one last thing I would do, and maybe you could list other things that would fill out your list, but I'd make sure I had time for prayer. I'm not sure prayer would have done Saul a whole lot of good at this point, the last 24 hours of his life. But I just wonder how many days I've lived and not prayed. But if it was the last day, don't you know that'd be the day that you'd make sure you got down on your knees and you'd talk to God. You'd make sure that anything that was amiss in your life, that you'd take care of that with the one that you would very soon face in judgment. I would, wouldn't you? Last 24 hours of your life. Paul said that in 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 16, that we ought to rejoice always and we ought to pray without ceasing. In everything give thanks. That means I'll pray every day because there's something I can give thanks for every day. No matter how many other things pressed me during the last 24 hours. I'll tell you what, I wouldn't answer the phone. TV would be off. No computer games. Wouldn't worry about a lot of things that now fill my life or grab part of my time. And please understand, I'm speaking in a hypothetical sense. I'm not saying that there's no room for any pleasure or any recreation in our lives. I understand that if we knew we had only 24 hours, we would live it a little differently than we would have to live every day otherwise. I'm going to go ahead and plan for retirement. I may not have time for retirement. But a man needs to plan. There needs to be some sort of preparations for the future. But my point is this. If you have 24 hours to live, you don't worry about stock trades. What would be the point? And you don't worry about whether you're going to miss the Frasier episode. Who cares? You see, you'd begin to order things differently in importance. And we do that anyway. It's just that sometimes our priorities may not be very good. And so we brush aside responsibilities toward brethren. We brush aside responsibilities and opportunities that we have with our families. We brush aside the opportunity to talk to God because we're just too busy. It's all about priorities. What would you do with the last 24 hours of your life? Well, I think we'd find time to pray. Lots of time to pray. I'll tell you some things I wouldn't do. I've already suggested some of them. I wouldn't worry about grabbing all the gusto. That's the commercial used to say. I wouldn't worry about living it up. I really do believe there are some folks who would do that. Because they have no hope, no appreciation for the fact that there's going to be something beyond the grave. And for them, the last 24 hours needs to be as fun-filled and action-packed as possible. Disney World, no lines. But what would be the point of that? Memories? At 24 hours. Not much time to worry about memories. And what will all that fun mean? What will all of that enjoyment entail or be worth when you stand before God in judgment? I wouldn't attempt to pile up material of goods. I'd listen to what Jesus said in Matthew, the 16th chapter, and verse 26. What does it make any difference? What does a man profit if he gains the whole world and yet loses his own soul? What will he give in exchange for his soul? He'll give everything. No stock trades. Wouldn't worry about whether or not I could make a little bit more money. Wouldn't worry about all the material things. 24 hours, what does it make any difference? When you're looking at the beginning of the rest of eternity, what could you possibly do in 24 hours to acquire wealth that would make any difference? Nothing. And yet, although each of us faces the possibility that we may be living in the last day of our lives, we scrabble around worrying about physical things as though it were the very thing that was the most important in our lives. And we make the mistake of the rich farmer of Luke 12. But if you knew, if you just knew that you only had one day left, you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't waste your time on things that are of relative importance. Now, once again, may I remind you, I understand we have to work. We need jobs in order to support ourselves, because it may be that I'm going to live many years and I'll need to plan for the future. But I'm telling you that I'm going to order my priorities today because I just don't know. And rather than putting aside spiritual things in preference for physical things, I would flip-flop those things whether I live one day or another 100 years. You see the point? You know what the rich man, the rich farmer's problem was? He didn't know what time it was. He thought he had a lot of years left. And the Lord said to him, "This night your soul will be required of you." When Saul heard that he had one more day, he fell out on the floor. He was paralyzed, apparently, with fear. I think he was afraid for himself. He wasn't prepared to die. Are we? The rich man's problem is he didn't know what time it was. He didn't realize that that very night his life was over. And he had been spending his time messing around with things that only had some point of value if he stayed here. And he wasn't staying. He was leaving. Don't miss the point of what James writes in James 4. "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit, whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, 'If the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that.' But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil." James is not forbidding planning. He's saying it's arrogant to assume that you will live another day or another year. You and I don't know that. And so that means that every decision that we made needs to be made in humility, with the recognition that today may very well be my last 24 hours. And boy, it would change the way I behave sometimes, wouldn't it? And perhaps you also. Now, I understand that there'd be some things you do in your last day that you might not do every day. But in terms of priority, in terms of importance of spiritual things, shouldn't we be doing all these things every day? Shouldn't these priorities pretty much describe our lives, whether we've got another day, or in the case of some of you, maybe years and years and years, but maybe not? Shouldn't we be doing these things anyway? Behaving toward our family the proper way, whether we've got one day or 50 years. Toward our brethren, whether it's one day, 24 hours, or another 20 years. Certainly. Certainly. I don't believe that we all live in fear of dying. I don't think we ought to be constantly immersed in the morbidity of the fact, the truth, that we just don't know how long we're going to live. I think there's no joy in that. And I believe we're intended to live in joy. Rejoice always, Paul said. And I think we ought to enjoy the peace that passes all understanding, as Paul wrote to the Philippians. But I disagree with the advice that Dr. Joyce Brothers gave one time in a column that I read, in which a woman wrote and asked her. She said, a family member has died, and I'm curious what you think about my children. Should my children be allowed? Should I take them to the funeral? Dr. Joyce Brothers, at least on that occasion, the gist of her advice was that children should not have to think about death lest it scare them. And I disagree with that. I think we can warp our children's perception of life. We can cause them to become morbid in their thinking. But on the other hand, death is a part of this world. And children have got to understand that. And they will understand that eventually, one way or the other. And we can either prepare them for that, or we can just throw them to the wolves. Maybe there is some judgment as to how early you should take a child to a funeral. But you know, that's a good opportunity for children to be reminded that mom and dad aren't going to be around forever, that grandma and grandpa aren't going to be around forever, and that all of us at some point are going to have to leave this world. Children need to understand that. And it's a good opportunity for them to understand that death is a transition from this temporal existence to an eternal existence. I think children need to be taught that. And funerals are not a bad way of illustrating that point. You've been so very kind this morning to listen. May I suggest to you that the major point I'm trying to make is that we cannot afford to procrastinate with certain things. Now, some of the things that I've talked about are not necessarily things of right and wrong. They're things of importance, of priority. It's not a sin if you don't tell your wife, well, maybe it is. Especially on your anniversary. You better get that right. It may not be a sin for you not to tell your children every day that you love them, but do you see the point? There are certain things that, because of their importance, we ought not to procrastinate. It's just not wise, because we just don't know what our lives will be. But I would say to you also, there are certain activities that are just not all that important. And I am constantly in the process, and I suspect many of you are also, of looking at your life and deciding what it is that will fit on your plate. And I know there are a lot of times I'm looking at my plate and I'm saying it's too full, I can't do everything. But then I realize there are things on my plate that don't have to be there. They're not the most important things. And I'm leaving off some of the important things. And so, thanks for playing the game with me. 24 hours to live. All of a sudden, you begin to look at the plate a lot differently, don't you? The things that you allow to be there. And of course, while I understand there are some things that would be peculiar about your last day, and we can't live every day as though there is no tomorrow, and yet in a sense, every day ought to be lived with the same general priorities as though it were the last day. And the question is, are you living that way? Because I'm afraid some of us are not. I know there are times when I have not. I read a story some years ago about a young lady who kept after her uncle, kept after him. She wanted him to become a Christian. He really didn't have a whole lot of interest in going to church with her. But she kept after him, and finally he agreed to come. And wouldn't you know it, as is the case so often, the preacher that day probably chose the most boring text you can find anywhere in the Bible. He preached out of Genesis 5. Familiar with that text? Genesis 5 is basically a genealogy. And it reads like this, beginning in verse 3. Adam lived 130 years and begot a son in his own likeness after his image and named him Seth. After he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years, and he had sons and daughters, so all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. And then the text goes on to talk about the next person, and then the next person, so-and-so lived so many years and begat sons and daughters, and then after that he lived so many years, and he died. And this young lady is thinking, oh, I can't believe of all the days that I get him here to services, to get him to go to church with me, and the preacher preaches on Genesis 5. But as they left the service, the uncle didn't have too much to say, and she was sweating. He'll never come back. But that night, every time the clock chimed, what the uncle heard was, and he died. Went to work the next day in his office. You know how you doodle, you pen, and all he could think to write was, and he died. Wicked, good, evil, or righteous, it's the same in that chapter with everybody. And he died. He lived and he died. And it made an impression on this man, because he realized that he was in that chapter. Lived and going to die. And he made the decision that he needed to make. It's not my intention this morning to be morbid or sensational, but I do believe that all of us need to be prepared to meet God every day. While I was in Brazil, I went to services at Parque Santo Antonio, and we parked below the building on the street. And I found out a little bit before services that there had been a woman murdered, drug deal went bad. She was murdered on the corner of the block where we parked. And as we left that night, Dennis and myself, and I guess Benita was there, the TV cameras were there, and they were starting their report talking about two men had come in there and murdered her. I went to Florida Hecum the night that I left, or maybe the next day. One of the brothers of one of the members of the church at Guadalupe, where I had preached that week twice, was beaten to death in a drug deal that went wrong. They beat him with a piece of wood until he was no longer recognizable, and his own brother pulled him out of the ditch. And my point is this: things happen that you don't expect. Sometimes life has a way of being cut off short when we least expect that we'll lose somebody we love. And so the point is, while we don't know if we have 24 hours to live, you need to be prepared today in case there is no tomorrow for you. And all that's left is the judgment. Hezekiah was told, set your house in order. And I ask you, is your house in order? If you have to meet God today, if this is the last day, are you ready for the judgment? A great day, a bright day for those who are prepared, and a very sad day for those who are not. There's only one way you can get through the next 24 hours, and that's for you, if you're not a Christian, to come to the cross and accept the grace that is available there through the blood of Jesus Christ. Confessing your faith in Jesus as the Christ. Baptized for the remission of your sins, He'll save you. And then it doesn't make any difference how many days you have left. You're prepared. Then you live faithfully doing those things that are commanded, that are important. But I'll tell you what, if you're not a Christian this morning, you need to take care of that now while you have the opportunity. Saul was right to be afraid. He was not ready to meet God. And if you're not a Christian this morning, you have every right to be afraid. If you're responsible before God, But the proper response is not simply fear, it's just to obey. To make the determination that you'll come to God and serve Him. The vast majority of the people here this morning are Christians. Ostensibly, we're prepared. Are we? As I talked to you oh so long this morning about your life, do you know within your heart that there are things that you need to change before the next 24 hours is up, before you meet God in judgment? And they may be things that you'll make changes in your lifestyle from here on out. Or maybe there are things that you need to take care of right now. You need to make some sort of confession based on your repentance of your sins. And the brethren need to know about that, if that's the case. And why not now? We encourage you as we stand and sing.